and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week. The blockade to the occupied territories is now official. The Ukrainian government has blocked the movement of all goods in and out of the region that has been seized by Russian-backed separatists. The decision to do so was made at an urgent meeting of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council. This has been preceded by 2 months of a blockade of rail lines and roads into the occupied territories in eastern Ukraine by war veterans and activists. At first, the government had not supported this blockade, arguing that Ukraine would incur losses more than several billion dollars due to blocking of coal delivery. Also, that half of Ukraine's power plants need anthracite coal to produce electricity. The war veterans and activists had insisted that doing business with the occupied territories amounted to financing terrorism, and that a blockade would stimulate a reform of the energy sector in Ukraine. But now, Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council has decided to implement the blockade due to an escalation of Russia's aggression against Ukraine and due to the seizure of Ukrainian businesses in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions by separatists, and of course, presumably under pressure from protesters in the streets. Having blocked the movement of goods officially, the government is expecting that this will reduce the tension in the region. Opponents of the decision have maintained that this will reorient the Ukrainian businesses towards doing business with Russia and facilitate the movement of the separatists' region away from Ukraine. France and Germany are among those who have criticized the decision. Sanctions against Russian banks. Ukraine has put sanctions in place against 5 Russian banks this week, which are functioning in the Ukrainian market. The banks are Sberbank, VS Bank, Prominvest Bank, VTB Bank, and BM Bank. The decision had followed days of protests by activists across the country. Activists even bricked up the entrance to a major bank, Sberbank, in central Kyiv. The protest started after Sberbank said it would recognize passports issued by Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Earlier, Russian President Putin had ordered Russian authorities to recognize identity documents issued by the separatists. Meanwhile, in the east of the country, there has been shelling in all sectors of the front line this week. The situation has been particularly tense around Avdiivka. Due to non-stop shelling attacks, the town of Avdiivka is once again without electricity and cell phone coverage is intermittent. Humanitarian organizations such as the Red Cross have been distributing bottled waters and candles. According to the Ministry of Defense, all across the front line and zone of conflict, 2 soldiers have been killed in action and 27 wounded. Meanwhile, there's an update to our story from last week about the arrest of the chief of Ukraine's tax agency, Roman Nasirov. Well, he has just been released from jail on a bail of 100 million hryvnia, or about $3.7 million, and is awaiting further decisions in his case. We reported last week that he had been detained and charged with fraud and embezzlement, and this has been a landmark achievement for Ukraine's independent anti-corruption bureau, NABU. In the meantime, the government attempted to appoint an auditor for the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, NABU, but the proposed candidate was met skeptically and with opposition from other parties and did not gather enough votes in the parliament. On a more positive note, Ryanair has entered the Ukrainian market. This week, Europe's biggest low-cost airline, Ryanair, officially announced its entry into the Ukrainian market. Ryanair intends to open up 9 new flights connecting Kyiv and Lviv with European destinations starting from October 2017. Tickets have already gone on sale. Another low-cost air carrier, Wizz Air, had also said it will be starting 4 additional flights to Ukraine this year. This comes at a time when demand for air travel is rising and Ukrainians are spending more on travel. According to the State Aviation Service of Ukraine, Ukrainian airlines saw a 31% rise in international passengers over the past year, while domestic flights in Ukraine saw a 27% increase. The number of passengers was even 2% more than in 2013, which would indicate that the market has come out of the recession of 2014-15. And there has been a special parliamentary meeting on Friday, the 17th of March, to commemorate the centenary of the Ukrainian Revolution. The first independent Ukrainian government, the Central Rada, was formed 100 years ago. This government led the national movement and, with its four declarations, went on to lead the country from autonomy to full sovereignty. In 1918, it set the precedent for a parliamentary democracy that was the basis for today's independent Ukraine. This week, we're going to be speaking on Ukraine Calling about the challenges facing Ukraine in this complicated setup on the international scene, where there seems to be not only a problem of Ukraine fatigue, but this enduring problem of countering fake news, standing up to Russia in the hybrid war that's going on. And I thought it's about time that we took stock of where we stand, look at the problems that we face and the challenges, but also look at what's being done to address these issues. And I've invited two people eminently qualified to talk about them. I'll invite them to introduce themselves first.
My name is Yulia Kozdobina, and I work for Ukrainian Independent Center for Political Research, and also I'm a volunteer advisor to the Information Policy Minister, and there I work on communication strategy for Crimea.
Excellent. So you're right in the thick of things.
And I'm Brian Mefford. I'm a senior non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council, and I've lived and worked in Ukraine for 18 years.
Wonderful. So let's start off by saying how good or how bad are things. It seems that when the Maidan was happening and shortly afterwards, there was a lot of international attention focused on Ukraine. But for various reasons, we don't seem to figure as much now in the headlines, in the coverage. And some of the news that we do get is not all favorable, or at least it seems very confused. Would you agree with that assessment, Brian?
Well, there's a sense that Ukraine has lost the momentum it had after Euromaidan, and there's reasons for that. Now, prior to Euromaidan, people talked about Ukraine fatigue, but it meant something different. Ukraine fatigue in the sense that, gosh, Ukraine can never get it right. They're always saying the right things, never doing the right things. Governments change, presidents change, nothing really changes. That was the old Ukraine fatigue. Now there's a new Ukraine fatigue, and the new Ukraine fatigue is somewhat different. The new Ukraine fatigue in Washington, at least, and somewhat Brussels, is too many Ukrainian politicians going there to pursue their own agenda. On a weekly basis, there's a whole parade of parliamentarians going to Washington now. Part of it has to do with the new presidential administration in Washington, but there has been just a steady flow of overlapping different factions, different MPs, and so forth, going to Washington, to the point that if you talk to people on Capitol Hill, they're basically saying, you know, we got it, Ukraine's important, but now let us do our work, because we can't constantly be meeting these parade of parliamentarians, all of whom admittedly think that their agenda is the most important on the planet. It is important, but they're also pursuing their own agendas.
And presumably this is happening in Brussels or in Strasbourg. Julia, how do you see the situation?
Well, I think I can't really comment on what Brian's saying, because I'm not really aware of that problem, right? But I'm looking more at the communication inside of the country and at what's happening inside of the country. And I think one of the reasons why we see that on the outside is that we don't really have a formed agenda inside. And we've been through very difficult times and many very many challenging things that happened to us, starting with the Revolution of Dignity, then the Russian aggression, the occupation of Crimea, and then the Donbass. And so it's a lot to actually digest and to be able to understand ourselves and to understand where we're going. And also, if you put things in the global context and you see what's happening in the European Union, you see the trends in the United States, the new president, and some of the things which look very, very confusing. And so at some point it was clear that we were going to integrate into the European Union, but now is there really a wholesome entity to integrate into? And so it's I can understand that there is a lot of confusion and a lot of uncertainty.
So conditions have changed, basically,
uncertainty.
Many
things have changed, and so we're finding our ways, and also we're going through the transformation inside of Ukraine, where people are learning that lose-lose is not the way to go forward, and so we need to really learn to communicate in a kind of win-win basis.
So it's interesting what I'm hearing from you. So you haven't started off by saying, yes, well, we've got this uphill struggle against Russian propaganda aimed at us. You're saying problems stem from issues inside the country and how we project ourselves abroad or don't project ourselves abroad. But let's look at how we're standing up to the fake news efforts, the hybrid warfare that's going on. Are we as Ukrainians, whether living here or abroad, are we holding ourselves up in this difficult situation?
Well, I think Russia is helping us immensely because it's not interfering only in Ukraine. It's now interfering in the West as well. And so if initially we were talking about the information warfare launched by the Russians, I think in the West people mostly thought about information warfare as a cyber warfare, right? And so nobody really thought about information warfare being disinformation campaigns and absolutely deliberate lying that Russia's doing. And so now the Russia's helping us immensely by going to Western countries and doing the same thing. And so people in the West are beginning to realize that Ukraine's not making it up. This is what's really happening.
But we hear that Russia is succeeding by blurring the issues, by blurring the distinction between truth and fake. And a lot of people who may be tangentially interested in Ukraine seem to be confused. Well, it's a local issue. Let the Russians and Ukrainians sort it out. It's far away from us. They seem not to have grasped the international and legal implications for the entire international system of what this behavior of Russia's occupying Crimea and intervening militarily in eastern Ukraine amounts to. Brian?
Well, I don't like to give the Russians credit very often, but they have launched a very sophisticated series of attacks, and whether not only the hybrid warfare on the battlefield itself, but in terms of informational policy, and of course at the information ministry, you guys have your hands full on a daily basis of combating this and pushing back against these fake news stories. I was recently. Recently wrote a column about not only fake news, but fake opinion pieces where articles that were put on websites to under a certain name, even though the problem was the person didn't write it. So this whole phenomenon has taken on a new life. And look, people get their information in different ways now than they used to do 20 years ago, where you had three main television networks. So now people are getting their news from Facebook. They're getting their news from Twitter. They're getting their news from, you know, Yahoo News. And so everything's changed, and that's affected Ukraine dramatically as well. Fortunately, Ukraine is actually very quickly adapting to the new rules of the game, so to speak, and pushing back and countering a lot of this propaganda. But in the early days of Euromaidan, the Russian narrative was the primary narrative out there. Now, fortunately, as Yulia points out, the international community is getting wiser to it. They're understanding things are not as as TASS or the Kremlin News Service puts it. So that's a good thing, but it has taken time to develop.
TASS and Russia Today, let's not forget, and the huge budgets that Russia is able to afford to pay people to troll and to put out stories and provide the opinion that they want. But how are the Ukrainian authority is reacting? You're an advisor to the Ministry of Information Policy. What is the capacity of the ministry to deal with this? Does the government, does the leadership of the country, to be frank, devote enough resources and enough attention to this problem?
Well, the ministry was formed at the end of 2014, right? And so we're basically just we've been around for 2 years, and we're the first year there was not enough funding at all, was barely enough to pay salaries to people. But I think it's a very dedicated team, and a lot of the people on the team are actually communication professionals, and. Also, the ministry is trying to take a strategic approach. So we're not just trying to counter every single fake out there. I think it's not really the job for the ministry. The ministry is working on developing the system of strategic communications, working with foreign partners. We're developing the foreign broadcasting capacity, and also participate very actively in different international forums and trying to bring Ukrainian vision. And also, our position is that Ukraine shouldn't be complaining and asking for help everywhere. We should be actually trying to contribute and share our experience and tell people in the West who fortunately have not seen the same kind of aggression as we've seen, try to warn them about certain things and share our experience and work together with them and try to find solutions together.
Okay. Could you give us, Julia, a few examples of what the ministry is doing as part of its strategy. Let's take the example of Crimea. How is it addressing this issue of the occupation of Crimea and its consequences for the Crimean Tatars and the population there?
We have first a deputy minister who's a Crimean Tatar, and she is very dedicated to Crimea and to Crimean Tatar cause as well. And so she's, if we talk about promoting Crimea internationally, she participates in many international events, and she also is very active in the information sphere here in Ukraine. And we're trying to develop a strategic approach also to communicating about Crimea. So the first stage was developing the broadcasting capability to broadcast into Crimea, because you probably know that when Russia occupied the peninsula, they basically cut all of the Ukrainian broadcasting, and they block access to Ukrainian websites. And so several radio stations received licenses. And now we're trying to develop the best content, how we can what needs to be conveyed to the residents of Crimea, and what needs to be conveyed to residents of Ukraine about Crimea, and what and how to convey to Western audiences about Crimea.
Is the ministry drawing on external expertise, people like Brian or people from the outside, professional journalists, commentators, analysts, to raise the professional level?
We try to do that, and a couple of days ago we had a focus group discussion with a number of journalists and analysts residing here in Ukraine, and I was very grateful for the opinions and information that people shared, because they gave me some very good ideas about what we can do and what's the better way to do it.
Okay, Brian, you've been living here quite a few years, and you're an analyst, you're a fellow of the Atlantic Council too. What would your tips be for both Ukrainians within the country that would like to project Ukraine's image more truthfully, accurately abroad? And also, if you have any tips for people listening out there that who might belong to the diaspora or may be concerned about the situation in Ukraine, what role can they play more effectively than perhaps they already are?
Well, one thing to address what I was talking about earlier with Ukraine fatigue is there needs to be more of a unified voice. Just as after the Orange Revolution, now after Euromaidan, everyone feels like, okay, we got rid of the bad guy, but now we can resume our old internal conflicts that have gone on for, you know, hundreds of years and so forth. That's a path to failure. If it led to failure after the Orange Revolution, it will lead to failure after Euromaidan. So Ukrainians need to speak with a unified voice. You know, General Wesley Clark used to say that whenever you leave American soil, you're no longer a Republican or a Democrat, you are an American. And that would be a wise foreign policy move for Ukrainians as they project in Washington, then Brussels and other capitals, is you're no longer for Tymoshenko or Poroshenko or Lyashko or Samopomich, you are a Ukrainian and you speak with a united voice. That would be a wise foreign policy move for Ukrainians. Now, the government obviously is making some efforts in that. And of course, just politics is going to be politics. People are going to try to promote their own image and advance their causes. And we saw that with Tymoshenko's intercept of Donald Trump on the way to the men's bathroom. So there's always going to be, you know, the political factor to it. You can't take that out. However, the battle for Ukraine is not done. Yes, the war is frozen for now, as we say. I mean, there's hostilities daily, but let's say the boundaries are not shifting at the moment. But there's still the battle against corruption. And as former U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt said, Ukraine faces two enemies, one on the battlefield and the other being corruption. And that is what Ukraine has to show some results on. If you show results, the messaging part's easy. So the hardest part for anybody in communications is when you have no message and no results.
Julie, maybe just for those representatives of the diaspora listening in North America or Britain, Australia, what else could they do at this stage to help you, to capacitate your efforts?
Well, one of the things is, I guess, English ability. We do need help with English very often, although there is a lot of effort being put into not only English, but foreign languages generally, because we get criticized a lot. There is this Ukrainian news state-owned news agency, Ukrinform, right? And it tries to supply news in different languages, but we get criticized very often for the language and for... But then again, with the amount of funding that we have, we can't really hire the best professionals. Unfortunately, that's the situation. And so I think that's where diaspora could really be helpful.
Are you uniting your efforts or synchronizing them with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or other ministries that might be relevant?
We're trying to work together, and on some instances it's successful, and in some it's not. But we're building up the cooperation. I think it's going to take time.
So it's still a learning curve.
Yes.
Though time is of the essence, in effect. Any final thoughts? What would you say have been the most promising moves forward in this area that have been made? The setting up of the ministry, the fact that the diaspora is behind you, or that you have a lot of good people, solid analysts, respected in the West, prepared to speak up, write about Ukraine?
Well, I think it's the understanding, if we were talking about the information sphere, I think it's the understanding at the level of the ministry that change is not going to happen overnight, that it's going to be a long uphill struggle, and teaching, there's a lot of work that's to be done to change the approach to communications in this country, communications between government and society, and inside society, and actually appreciate the value of communication, because in the Soviet Union, that was not the case. We were just told from the top what we need to be doing. There was no communication. There was just ordering and instructions. And so it's going to change. And but there is understanding that we need to be working, and there is a plan and understanding where we're going and how we're going to get there.
Good. And Brian, we mentioned that Ukraine shouldn't just harp on about being a victim, being aggressed as it is, but to project a positive side, to show its contribution and its place in the scheme of things. Apart from being effective, delivering on reforms, fighting corruption that you mentioned, what else could it do? How can it get across to the broader international public the gravity of the issues, the complexity of the issues, and how in the longer term this affects other countries?
Well, one thing, in addition to, you know, fighting reforms or achieving reforms and fighting corruption, is that they also avoid this constant cycle of elections. There's even some talk about maybe elections will take place in the autumn. That would be a disaster for Ukraine right now. People need time. The government needs time to govern. And this constant cycle of elections serves only the politicians, not the Ukrainian people. That would be something that they could do concretely to demonstrate that. But also, Ukraine now is on the forefront on the battlefield. The advances in the Ukrainian military are huge over the last 2 to 3 years. In the informational policy side and the informational warfare side, Ukraine is on the front lines, and that experience is valuable because other countries will be experiencing the same problems Ukraine has. You know, today it's Ukraine, tomorrow maybe it's Georgia again, or it's Moldova, or it's the Baltics. So Ukraine's experience is unique. There's no better experience than going through something yourself. So that experience can be shared, and Ukraine will no longer be the victim, but somebody that can teach and share that experience with other countries.
Okay, well, time has run out. Obviously, a lot more can be said on this subject, but I think we've got across to our listeners the challenges, the complexities that we face, but also the hard work that some of our colleagues are doing, both in the country and outside, to set the record straight and to elicit that support and move forward. So I want to thank Julia Kozdobina, for speaking with us, an advisor to the Ministry of Information Policy, and Brian Melford, an independent political analyst, but also a fellow of the Atlantic Council. Thank you for your contributions today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we'll move on to our weekly cultural section. And now moving on to culture. Well, an important retrospective exhibition of Tetyana Yablonska is taking place at the National Art Museum in Kyiv. Yablonska was a painter who started out working in socialist realism, but had a tendency towards impressionism. Many of her works were awarded prizes, although at the same time her major works ran into controversy with the authorities for not conforming enough to socialist realism. Yablonska explored some eternal themes and developed with the best traditions of Ukrainian painting. The National Art Museum has the largest collection of her works, and this exhibition is an opportunity to see some pieces that are Ukrainian classics. Meanwhile, also this week in Kyiv, several works by the scandalous, as some regard him, avant-garde, as others see him, cutting-edge, as still others see him, Ukrainian writer and playwright and dramatist Les Poderevyansky have been on stages in Kyiv. I saw his riotously unconventional play, or rather musical, Zviri, Animals, the other night, in which we had the bizarre, if not grotesque, spectacle of Stalin and Hitler dancing together. And here's an improvisation on a theme. Vera Bondar is a Ukrainian classical rock guitarist. Here she teams up with Crimean Tatar legend Enver Ismailov to give you their take on Deep Purple's Smoke on the Water. Please enjoy. Thank you. Looking forward. Next week, we will be following the main stories in Ukraine again. Tune in for a new episode. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. Ukraine Calling, lowercase, one word, at Hromadske Radio, lowercase, one word, .org. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.